This is Inside the Magic Studio with your host, Robert Martin, the interview podcast with the best in Magic the Gathering. I'd like to thank GatheringMagic.com, where you can find this show and some of the best articles in Magic and Cool Stuff, Inc. Our guest this episode is Tom Martell.
With the ability to turn one card, Lingering Souls, into a GP Legacy title and a Pro Tour championship, my first question is, should Lingering Souls be banned?
I mean, I think anytime you're talking about banning, it has to be very, very format specific. And I've obviously played Lingering Souls now in a variety of formats. It actually did get banned in Block Constructed, where the size of that card pool made the card just way too good. If you look at something like Standard, there's so many things that fight against it. It's not. We didn't even play four copies in our main deck of the card, and there are so few matches we even want for it. It's very powerful, certainly, but it's not kind of a format defining or dominant card in a lot of cases. Look at something like Legacy. Legacy, the format, it's so dynamic and changes so much tournament to tournament. And Lingering Souls, while arguably the best card in the format against other kind of fair creature decks, I think it's the best card in the deck against all the other kind of, Stoneforge Mystic decks, the best card against all the kind of other, kind of aggro creature decks. It's basically atrocious against any of the unfair decks. It's just too slow. So it's an interesting card because it really makes you, make sacrifices and make commitments to kind of where you want your matchups to be positioned. I think that's the definition actually of a good card for a format, not one that really deserves banning.
All right, I'm going to ask, because when you first started working with Lingering Souls, how did you know it was going to be such a good card for you?
I had absolutely no idea. I think the first time we really played with it was, I think I have my timing right, the first time was at Pro Tour Dark Ascension, which was in Honolulu. Where we played with kind of Spirit Delver, and the card was awesome in that deck. And in that testing for that tournament, I really liked the card. We had it, in and out of various versions of decks, but it was my kind of first experience playing with it. I did very well there. It went 9-1 in Standard, and my limited game really let me down. But you saw John Finkel, obviously, top 8 with the deck and showcase the power of it. And then actually, the night before I flew to Indy, which was kind of the next tournament that I played with the card, I was actually on the phone with Sam on the way to the airport to take a red-eye to Indianapolis, and he's telling me about this version of kind of Esper Stoneblade that had Lingering Souls in it. And I had a lot of skepticism about the card. It didn't seem to me to be, a Legacy-type card. But I actually played very little Legacy up to that point, and Sam said, no, he thinks it's pretty well-positioned. And I said, hey, I really enjoyed that card, and it's fun to play with. I'll throw it in there. And the morning of the tournament, actually, I showed my list to Jerry Thompson, and he's like, man, this list sucks. What are you doing playing this Lingering Souls card? There's no way this is a Legacy card. And then, obviously, the rest of them at that point is history. So it was probably that tournament when I realized kind of exactly how versatile and powerful the card was across formats.
When I interviewed Sam, he said that you have the ability of taking a sideboard and playing with it differently than maybe they wanted you to, because the ability to make great in-game adjustments.
I think that's fair. I think that's certainly one of my strengths is, and it's actually funny too, because afterwards, I it's almost like I'm so in the zone that I couldn't even tell you what I did. I was trying to come up with how I sideboarded for past tournaments looking at decks I played with, and I knew at the time I had such a compelling sideboard vision, and I can't come up with it again. It's actually kind of strange how quickly it leaves my mind. But in the moment, I mean, I've played obviously a ton of Magic. I've played a ton of other games like that where you need to be kind of just tinkering with the positioning of the matchups and really understand kind of how you're going to win games. And that's something that on the fly I think I'm really good at adjusting, and I can just process a lot of disparate information and synthesize it into a coherent strategy faster than other people. I think it benefits me, one, in like when I'm playing formats where everyone doesn't know what they're doing, like new sets or mixes of cards, I think I pick them faster. But I probably plateau sooner. So it's all that kind of that quick response being exposed to new situations that I just, for whatever reason, my brain kind of works that way.
Speaking of your brain working a different way, when you prepare for a Pro Tour with Team SCG Black, what is your role on the team?
That's maybe comic relief. I don't have a kind of as defined a role as someone like Sam or Patrick, Patrick Chapin. Both of whom are very much defined as they're building decks. They're trying things out. Alluding to kind of what Sam talked about there with why I can sideboard on the fly pretty well. I think I'm good at kind of looking at two decks, playing some games, getting a really really quickly developing an understanding of how these decks should match up over a larger sample size, so I can extrapolate results without grinding a lot of games. That's helped me a lot in kind of maybe doing a little bit of direction, saying, oh, hey, you know, if you know, Patrick's telling us the field can look like XYZ, this deck might not be where we want to spend our time focused on, because it's, I think it's going to be really hard. It just has like a structural deficiency in these matchups, and you're not going to be able to fix that. I'm not always right with those kind of blanket assertions, but that's really what I'm trying to do, is get those big picture viewpoints where I can give that cover and that direction to someone like Sam, who then goes in and says, okay, I'm going to keep trying to attack this problem in different ways. Also kind of a sounding board. You know, if Sam's thinking about decks, instead of sitting down and playing 20 games each one, he can kind of, you know, fire some ideas out there. And with the framework of games that I've played, I can kind of plug those ideas in and think about, you know, mentally play out some games and say, oh, that would have changed the matchup in the following three ways. That's worth testing. Let's try some more. Let's actually validate this opinion.
Okay, give me a little insight on what it's like to work with the amount of talent on that team.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's such an advantage having such a skilled team around you. And you know, I think my results are very much dependent and a product of that. Excuse me, of that setup. I think my results would be much, much worse if I didn't have, I couldn't rely on the team that I availed to me, both for constructed and limited. And it's nice because it means, one, you can outsource a lot of the labor. So when someone comes back and, you know, and when Owen and Reed have played 50, 60 post-sideboard Jund mirror games, for instance, which what they were doing, you know, the day, 2 days before the PT, I know that if, at the end, I'm out there, you know, trying out some of Sam's more fringe kind of crazy decks. If we don't get there, I have an amazing fallback plan. If I have this matchup that's been ground, you know, I have this deck that's been tuned by two really exceptional Magic players, and it's going to be a really good falling back point. So having that safety net in place lets kind of freezes up to try out crazier things, take more chances, and know that no matter what happens, we're going to have a great deck for the tournament.
I have to ask about the scarf. It really, it almost got as many pictures with the title as you did.
They may have gotten more, I think, actually. But
why the scarf?
Yeah, I mean, it was a joke. Obviously, it was funny. I thought, and it was people. I have a little showman to me at times, and people obviously resonate and kind of like those kind of storylines. You saw this with, you know, Brian and the tiger hat in Honolulu, and for me, it was kind of the same sort of fun storyline. So, you know, that morning it was freezing cold outside. I was wearing like a flimsy jacket, and I go outside from the hotel with John to head over to the site, and he sees me standing there, you know, heading for top eight, shivering. He takes his scarf off and puts it on, ties it around my neck, and I'm like, all right, well, John, if John Finkel's put this on me, I'm not going to take this off. It's going to, you know, kind of what his hands have made, I can't undo. And obviously I was joking, and then I started winning and kept winning, and I'm not a superstitious guy. I don't think having the scarf on in any way affected my play. But it made for a kind of a more engaging and more entertaining story for people, and I, you know, I'm happy to play along with that.
The first Pro Tour championship for you, was there any point in the top eight where you felt you might be in trouble of not winning it?
It's weird. So, I mean, at no point did I think I was going to win. Maybe that's not fair. When I made it to the finals, I thought I was winning the Pro Tour. I thought I was definitely a favorite at that point, but no point was I worried about losing, which is very different from my other experiences. So in the video, actually, there's a video of me in the finals at GP Indianapolis, and there's just, if you, I don't know if you've seen it, but you know, it's a bunch of YouTube hits, and the last thing that happens is they cut away from me, and I'm saying how nervous I was. And if you watch that match, I think it shows, like, my play there is not, you know, it wasn't very crisp. I was so terrified of losing because I wanted to win so badly. And having gone through that, I think really helped prepare me for this. So, you know, I had a PT top eight before in Paris. I let that one get away. This time I was, just, you know, I was like, okay, I've been here before. I'm not overwhelmed by just being in a Pro Tour top eight, and people don't get how overwhelming it is. And I think we saw that with Owen, you know, I mean, he obviously made a mistake against Aoife that he would never normally make. He's, you know, way too good of a magic player for that kind of play, but it's so different being in your first top eight. So it was really nice, you know, not having those nerves and just, you know, being just thrilled to be there, very comfortable in the moment, understanding that, you know, I thought I was dead. I thought I had no chance to beat Melissa in the quarters. So I had no expectations. There's no kind of pressure on me for that. It was kind of playing with the house money at that point and just kind of rolling from there.
Is there a difference when you sit down at a table playing a best 3 out of 5 instead of a 2 out of 3 match?
I mean, you definitely have more leeway for, you know, getting unlucky, certainly. And I don't know if that had something to do with it. Maybe it did. Maybe the impact of any individual point of variance I knew was going to be lessened. I mean, I certainly historically, and this is an issue that John mentioned in his turn report for this tournament on Star City a week or two ago, talks about how, you know, in the past, I've always had issues, you know, tilting and just keeping level headed. Maybe the knowing that I had, you know, best of five series, I had some time, I had some variants to give away, helped me kind of move past that. But for once in my life, it didn't really come up in this tournament at all, and I was just, you know, very calm.
I understand that a GP, there's a lot of people right on top of you. But at a Pro Tour event, when you're playing in those final tables, it's realistically like you're almost alone.
Mm-hmm.
Is that more difficult to deal with?
Not for me. So it's actually funny you mentioned the people on top of you. So GP Charlotte, which is that huge limited GP, I was in a feature match, which is typically kind of as alone as you get at a GP playing. It's Patrick Sullivan around four. When next, you know, Soda just launches across our table. And at that moment, more than any other time, I really felt like I was, you know, surrounded by the masses. Some guy above us watching the match opened some soda and it detonated. So very, very contrasted to that is you're playing the feature match at the Pro Tour, and there's you, your opponent, and maybe a coverage guy, and that's it. And I grew up playing chess, which is, you know, a much more of a kind of a quiet, solitary activity where you're watching your game, you're getting up, you're walking around while your opponent's thinking. It's just very much you spend a couple hours only in your own head. So for me, I'm fine with that. And it's actually even easier for me to focus when I'm in the feature match area. So I like that. I like kind of getting away, you know, not having a ton of people around, just being able to really just be me and the game. It helps me kind of clear my thoughts.
But we'll use the example you brought up earlier of Owen. Owen has really done well at GPs, where there have been people all over the place and around him. Could have that moment of being by himself may have gotten to him.
It's certainly possible. I'm not sure kind of how that plays out in your mind. You know, it's weird. It's different. So maybe it's if people are watching you play differently than if no one is. I know it certainly can affect. I've talked to people who that affects. You know, it's like if no one's watching, I'll keep a looser hand. Or maybe if no one's watching, I'll play tighter. When people are watching, I'm more, you know, I want to kind of more show off for the crowd and do crazier things. That can bias people. Owen, I don't think that affects him at all. I suspect, I mean, it's the GPs are very different. Owen is an incredible player against when playing against bad players. And I don't mean that means he's a bad player playing against good players. I mean, it's a different skill set of being able to get in the head of people who aren't pro level and really understand where they're coming from, what they're doing. It's something I'm not as good at, actually, because I don't understand kind of what level to put an opponent on. So I struggle. I don't get to capitalize as much on my kind of play skill differential with someone who's newer to the game as I think Owen does. And I think Owen gets every single ounce of advantage he can. And then the GP that comes up a lot. And over a lot of GPs, you're going to perform much, much better than the mean will, because you're just getting extra edge there. And I think that would probably have a lot more to do with why he does so much better at GPs than PTs than the crowd element to it.
But has the environment of SCG Black may have affected him in a better way?
It's a very different set of personalities. And I think we've seen that. I think Owen has, I think Owen's matured a lot in recent years. You know, he's growing up. He's, you know, he was a young guy when he got into Magic and, you know, I remember myself at that age, and I'm, you know, completely different person now. And I think we're seeing some of that happening kind of before our eyes. I'm not sure if that's because of Star City Black or not, but certainly being surrounded by an older group of people who are, I think, probably more focused on doing well and less about, you know, you look at China Firewall and they're goofing around. They're, you know, they're going out to the long dinners. They're hanging out. There's much more kind of there's just a younger element to it. And we, while we're still certainly having fun in our testing, it is your testing with, you know, guys who've been here for a long time who are just older and bring kind of a more mature perspective in some cases, not always, to the table. And that's probably rubbed off on him some.
Has the possibility of making the world championship team caused you to play too much Magic?
Not really. So I think I at least flight these trips booked already in advance. And then I won the PT and realized, oh, wow, okay, I don't need pro points anymore except to become kind of national team captain. That would certainly be an incredible honor. I would love to do that. But I'm not going to lose any sleep if that doesn't happen. You know, at this point, I've already accomplished a ton this season. I'm really thrilled to, you know, be going to Amsterdam for the individual world championships. That's going to be awesome. And it's almost I don't even want the distraction of the team event as well on top of that. So that really hasn't influenced my behavior at all. I'm just a little burnt out. I mean, I've been just working really hard recently. There's been a ton going on. I've been traveling a bunch and kind of felt like I've been on the road every weekend. And so Pittsburgh is much more – and also, I haven't really won a match since the Pro Tour, which is – you know, it's – obviously, if I could trade it in, I would lock this up every time. But it certainly is frustrating now to have gone through, you know, three GPs in a row where I feel like I can't beat anyone. It's not a great feeling. And so it's much more kind of just being burnt out from that and wanting to get home and just kind of take a step back and regroup. Had a lot more to do with it.
I understand that you're getting a token made of yourself, like the rest of the Star City Games members. Is it going to be unusual to see yourself on the battlefield?
I think it's going to be really cool. I'm extremely flattered that, you know, people want a token of me. I think that's awesome. And, you know, my mom is very excited to get a couple copies of herself. So it's going to be just cool. I think it's just a lot of fun. And I'm, you know, very proud that that's something that's going to be made and going to be, you know, around for forever. And it'll be awesome the first time someone beats me with one. I will not have a problem losing it to myself.
All right. What about the first time someone asks you to sign it?
That's, I mean, obviously that's going to be part of kind of hand in hand in that. The first time someone asked me to sign a card, actually, I remember, I think it might've been Ricky Hiashi was the very first person. He asked me to sign a Thrun, because it's for a while there. I was, the Martrol, and that was super cool. And the first time somebody signed some Lingering Souls, that was awesome. But the token obviously is even more special because it's me. There's no kind of gap there. And I really look forward to hopefully signing a lot of them.
Now, you have a larger than life personality on and off the Magic area. How has that helped you in your career in Magic?
I mean, I don't know if I guess maybe that's a fair description. I don't think of myself as kind of larger than life, but I'm certainly can be, you know, outspoken and boisterous. So I think that's maybe not unfair. I think it can help and hurt. There's two sides to it because, you know, it's when you put yourself in the center of attention, there's a higher scrutiny on things you're saying. And the way you're behaving. So you need to keep that, you need to be very conscious of that and understand that there's a, you know, you're kind of accepting a higher responsibility for what you're doing. At the same time, also you get to meet a lot more people. And that's certainly very helpful within the, you know, kind of the Magic context is getting to know people, having fun with them, forming bonds, and then later on getting the chance to kind of work with those same groups of people, is certainly a huge plus.
You also did a lot of Magic TV where you would, again, you would expound on those statements and comments and make your opinions well known to the whole world. Do you miss doing something like that, or do you make that up by doing more Twitch TV?
So I wish I had way more time in the day just so I could stream more. I love streaming. I love interacting directly with fans and just people who love Magic. I love, you know, Q&As and talking to them about what's going on and just getting that hands-on access. So Magic TV was still a degree removed. I mean, people submitted topics, and we kind of, you know, went back and forth on them. It wasn't as kind of close to the ground, so I love the streaming aspect of it. But, I mean, I'm an opinionated guy. You know, I certainly have strongly held opinions on a lot of things, and I like the chance to both express those and have them be tested because I think the way we really improve ourselves as individuals, as thinkers, and we improve the community is by rigorously debating some of these kind of core issues and figuring out through that process like what really is best for the collective people and everyone involved. And so, you know, now Twitter's a great outlet for that. You know, I certainly am not shy about tweeting kind of my feelings about a lot of topics. You know, most recently the thing that stands out was, you know, there's obviously been some backlash to the community. Some people are incapable of behaving like human beings when it comes to, you know, whether it's female players or you know, LGBT members of the community. I took to Twitter on that. I think it's just outrageous. Like, these are our fellow Magic players, and first and foremost, and it's unacceptable to behave that way. I liked having the platform of Magic TV to voice those opinions because I think it's really important.
I mean, you talked earlier about your schedule between work and Magic and all that stuff and the streaming you do. How much more do you think you can do without suffering from what we talked about earlier, burnout?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to kind of scaling it back a little bit, I think, next year, and we'll see how much that actually ends up happening, but it's going to need to at least a little bit. Just with my work schedule, like, work comes first for me, especially right now. You know, I work at a startup, you know, it's a 90-person company that I've been there since you know, we were 10 people. And so I think that, you know, given that, I need to really keep prioritizing that more and more over time, so we'll see kind of how that affects things in terms of, you know, my kind of Magic career going forward. I still really, really want to make the Hall of Fame. It would mean so much to me to do so that I know I need, you know, at least one or two more big results to get there. So it'd be a big push for me to do that in the kind of coming year or two. And then we'll kind of reassess from there.
You've got the first win, which is usually one of the staples of making the Hall of Fame, is you need the Pro Tour win, or you need, as Sam said, 3 to 4 top eights in the Pro Tour.
Yep.
I'm still trying to wrap this as a person who plays the game, how difficult it is to even make the top 32 of a Pro Tour. To have multiple top eights and or a win, in your case, you've already got two.
Yep.
You think you need two more top eights?
I think it depends. So it depends on what the kind of voters look at. So I think, I mean, my career, while very long in time, is very short in number of Pro Tours. I think I've played in 13 Pro Tours now. And I think given – if people kind of take that into account and they think, you know, with 13 Pro Tours and one of them I played in when I – you know, it was my fifth Magic tournament ever was a Pro Tour actually, and I had no idea what the hell I was doing. So if you think about the 12 I've played in that were, you know, kind of competitive, I have top 32 or better half of them. If they look at those kind of rate stats and they weigh those and they value that, I think I have a chance with one more top eight. But probably do need two more. I think four with a win is these days kind of the threshold to be in serious consideration. And so if I can pick up those, you know, in the next year or two, my top eight percentage will be, I think, maybe even better than PB's just on a pro, you know, because I play so few Pro Tours that'll give me a great shot.
Your Magic career, you just talked about, expanded time from Pro Tour Chicago in 2000 to now. What has changed for better or worse for you, in your opinion, when it comes to Magic?
And the game's obviously very different, and my interaction with the game has changed tremendously. So when I went to Pro Tour Chicago in 2000, like I mentioned, it was my like fifth or sixth Magic tournament ever. I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I didn't have any connections with people. It was just like I didn't understand kind of how awesome it was to be there yet. I hadn't tried hard enough. It kind of came too easily. Got my butt handed to me. I actually just did atrociously, which was deserved because I had no idea what I was doing. So you're asking about the kind of how Magic has changed since 2000.
Yeah, for better or worse.
Yeah, so it's the game. I mean, the design of Magic has changed dramatically. So if you look at the kind of the cards they were printing and the decks they were pushing back then versus now, now we have a much more kind of creature focus. Individual cards are much more powerful. It feels like, because, you know, again, because creatures have been pushed so much, that's very different. You know, it's not better or worse, in my opinion. Like, it's worse for me, because I like to play with, you know, spells and less creature combat, but for the game, it's obviously done very well in terms of sales. In terms of the community itself, you know, it's changed, but it's really just grown, and I think that's much better. You see, you know, a lot of the players that I looked up to and was following in coverage back when I was trying to break in 2000 are back and playing again, and, you know, whether it's John and Kai or Huey, we're seeing a ton of these guys come back, and that's awesome. Is that now we get to have, you know, just multiple generations now of kind of great Magic players involved in the game. So that's been a great boon to kind of how things are going. We have the fourth Pro Tour back, so I can't complain that it's getting worse because they're supporting the PT less. That's, you know, a great kind of recent change. I think as long as, you know, Magic keeps growing as sort of a, you know, an intellectual sport, it's awesome for everyone involved. And I think we haven't maybe done as much of that growth in the last decade as I would have expected if you'd asked me in 2000. I still think the last 5 years have been tremendous, and we're seeing a real inflection point, a real kind of surge in that growth. And I'm excited to see kind of what happens in the next 5 years.
Is there something that you think the culture of the community can do to make things better? I mean, we still, like you discussed earlier, have issues with players not accepting of other players and certain actions that are still happening within the community that's, for the year that we're in, is quite unacceptable.
I mean, you look at it in the context of the Magic community and say, sure, like, I would love for that to be very different, and I want it to be, and I'm going to keep working for that to happen. But you look at the country as a whole and you see the same issues, right? I mean, it's not like this is something that's confined to Magic players where we're so unaccepting or we're so bigoted different areas. That's unfortunately the reality of the world that we currently live in. And you see this, you look at the Supreme Court who is considering overturning or upholding Prop 8 in California, and you look at these, issues around marriage equality and people lashing out at other people and not treating them like humans. We're as guilty as that as anyone else in society. Like our community has those types of people. We need to keep trying to reform them. We need to keep telling them that's not acceptable here. Either you need to change your behavior, you need to get out. And I think that kind of zero tolerance policy for our fellow magicians, is just the same thing I want to see in society at large. It's not really a unique magic problem.
One of the things that's pretty clear about when you interview someone like Tom is the fact that the people that work with him know how great his mind is when it comes to magic. He tends to see things that a lot of players don't see, which is why his game has improved so much. I'd like to thank Gathering Magic for hosting this show, along with Cool Stuff, Inc., and you, the listener, for listening to this week's show. If you have any issues, questions, thoughts, people you'd like to see on the show, please email me at themagicstudio1@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.